The following podcast contains advertising. To access an ad-free version of the Lawfare podcast, become a material supporter of Lawfare at patreon.com/lawfare. That's patreon.com/lawfare. Also, check out Lawfare's other podcast offerings, Rational Security, Chatter, Lawfare No Bull, and The Aftermath.
Planning for your next trip? Elevate your travel style with Quince. Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/trip for free shipping and 365-day returns.
One of the things that the administration does extremely poorly is explain why they're doing things. That would have calmed a lot of this anxiety and stamped down on the rumors, from which I conclude that the administration's actually quite happy to have wild, swirling rumors, which is completely irresponsible for a commander-in-chief to do during a presidential transition.
I'm Benjamin Wittes, and this is the Lawfare Podcast, November 13th, 2020. Corey Shockey is a longtime Pentagon watcher. She is a former Defense Department, State Department, and National Security Council official, and she leads the foreign policy and defense policy team at the American Enterprise Institute. She is also the author of an article in The Atlantic this week about the latest, I don't know what to call it, mishigas at the Pentagon. A decapitation strike against the military-civilian leadership of the United States by the President of the United States. She tries to make sense of it all, and I thought it was the subject that needed to be talked about on the Lawfare podcast today, so I asked Corey to join me in the virtual jungle studio to walk through it all. Why is the President firing all the leaders of the Department of Defense? Is this a grand plan to do something terrible in the last 2 months of his campaign, or is this just flailing narcissism? And even if it's the latter, what harm could it do? It's the Lawfare Podcast, November 13th. Corey Shockey on what the heck is going on at the Pentagon. All right, Corey, let's start this with just a survey of the battleground. What do the casualties look like so far?
The Secretary of Defense has been fired, the Undersecretary of Defense for Intelligence, the Undersecretary of Defense for Policy, and the Chief of Staff to the Secretary of Defense. And they have all been replaced by people who would be extremely unlikely to be confirmed for those positions if put before the Senate for review. In fact, one of them was put before the Senate for review, and under advisement from Republicans in the Senate, his nomination was withdrawn.
And that's Anthony Tata, is that right?
Yes, that's right.
All right, so normally when we have people who are suddenly removed, for example, Jeff Sessions, we knew exactly why Jeff Sessions was fired. Or Jim Comey, the president didn't really make a secret of why he was firing Jim Comey. Here, it is unclear what the motive behind any, let alone all, of these firings are. Is that correct?
Well, I think the motive is pretty transparent where the Secretary of Defense is concerned. Namely, the three strikes against him were first that last summer during the protests, he publicly opposed the president invoking the Insurrection Act to call up troops to police the nation's cities. Second, he supported as a policy ending the naming of American military bases for Confederate traitors, something that the president very much opposed. That is, the president wants American military bases named after traitors. And third, it sounds like he had a not particularly good relationship with the National Security Advisor, who reportedly pushed for his firing. So I think those three things. Oh, also, I think the president has a general dislike for the senior military and civilian leadership of the department because they have different views about the pace of drawing down American involvement in the war in Afghanistan than the president does.
So all of this makes a lot of sense to remove a defense secretary who disagrees with you about fundamental things if you've just been reelected to a second term and you're going to have to make policy. But if you're yourself the lamest of lame ducks and you're just waddling along for another 70 days, it's not clear to me why you want to, ducks don't ride horses, but why you would want to change horses right at the edge of the stream like this. I mean, is there any logic to it, or is it, I mean, all the reasons that you've given, whatever you think of the policy merits of any of those questions, like, they're not going to have big impacts over the next 70 days, right?
It would be highly unusual if they did have big impacts over the next 70 days. You know, the Department of Defense is a $740 billion a year business with over 2 million employees. It would take an enormous amount of effort to have major policy changes, especially since the people who really run American defense policy reside on Capitol Hill, not at 1600 Pennsylvania Avenue.
All right. So the next question is, who is Mr. Esper replaced by? So listeners of this podcast may have a sense of his replacement because he's been the sort of acting guy at the National Counterterrorism Center. My own sense of him is that he's got a pretty solid reputation in that capacity. But you wouldn't really think of Christopher Miller as SecDef material. What do we know about him, and what's the word on the street about him?
So I think your assessment's right, Ben. He has a solid reputation as a soldier. He's done reasonably well, I think, in his current job. But in January, he was nominated to a position four echelons beneath the one he's just been elevated to.
So what was that position?
Let's see. Was it a Deputy Assistant Secretary of Defense or the Assistant Secretary for Special Operations and Low Intensity Conflict?
I see. So really actually measurably beneath, literally four levels below the position he now holds. That's a meteoric rise.
Yes, that is a meteoric rise.
Was Esper qualified for that position?
Not overly so, but he had been a successful Secretary of the Army. He's a veteran. He worked in the defense industry. So, you know, he wouldn't have been one of the best qualified secretaries in American history, but he wasn't unqualified.
So let's talk about the next victim, who was the chief of staff. Who was she, and what do we know about her, and why do we know about why she was replaced?
We don't know anything about why she was replaced, but she was replaced by someone from Devin Nunes's staff. The influx of people to the Defense Department jobs, the replacements for the people who've been fired, almost all of them had a connection to Devin Nunes' staff, and that's what's making people so nervous.
Right. And so this is an interesting thing, because when I think of Devin Nunes, he is not merely, and that staff is not merely a highly partisan staff, but it's not a particularly high quality staff. And to have people like Kash Patel and Ezra Cohen-Watnick, who's a Michael Flynn person, suddenly taking over the Defense Department feels like you're kind of reaching into the worst, most conspiratorial parts of the fever swamp and giving them sort of real power all of a sudden.
Yes, that's exactly what people are worried about. So Jen Stewart, the former chief of staff to the secretary, had been minority staff director for the House Armed Services Committee. And so the people they're pushing out are unquestionably better qualified and more mainstream defense types than their replacements.
And that brings us to Anthony Tata, the saga of whom is a bit older than this week. He was considered by Senate Republicans to be unsuitable for this position. Now he has it anyway. What are people's anxieties about him? And do you expect any pushback from the same Senate Republicans who warned the White House that he was unconfirmable?
Sadly, I do not expect much pushback because he has been informally doing this job or advising the undersecretary for some time. The Senate Republicans declined to enforce Congress's right to restrict people coming into positions in cabinet departments without confirmation when they let Anthony Tata be working in the building.
And then in addition to this spree, there was the immediate pre-election removal of the official in charge of nuclear security issues. What do we know about that?
So it's also not clear why Lisa Gordon Haggerty was removed from the NNSA job either. So one of the things that the administration does extremely poorly is explain why they're doing things. That would have calmed a lot of this anxiety and stamped down on the rumors, from which I conclude that the administration's actually quite happy to have wild, swirling rumors, which is completely irresponsible for a commander-in-chief to do during a presidential transition.
Right. I mean, this is not the Environmental Protection Agency, where if there are some rumors about why things are happening, you know, I suppose that's bad, but it's not the worst problem in the world. This is, after all, the U.S. nuclear stockpile and, you know, forces deployed all over the world.
Mm-hmm. One other appointment, Ben, a little bit lower in the staff, but significant, is that the director of the National Security Agency has just been forced over his objections to take as his general counsel another Nunes protege.
Yes, Michael Ellis, who has been more recently at the National Security Council and I believe graduated from law school during the Obama administration. So let's talk about what this big picture represents, which is the subject of your Atlantic article. And you tick through several different possible theories that could explain it, given how little information we have. And so let's just go through them. The first one that you're pretty dismissive of is the idea that this is some effort to seize control or have loyalists in control of the military for purposes of preventing a transition of power. So I agree with you that this is a very unlikely explanation, but I want to make the best case for it that I can and then let you rebut it. If I were going to have a coup while as president, I would be very concerned about the military. You know, the U.S. military, they swear their own oath to the Constitution. And if you were the president and you were planning to maintain power, you would have to worry about the behavior of the military when you tried to do it. This all happens as the president is refusing to accept the results of an election and as he is fraudulently claiming election fraud. Why shouldn't people see it in that context as a threat to the constitutional order?
It's a great question, and it's important for us to understand that the American military are moral agents. Not only do they take their oath to the Constitution, but they are individually responsible for the choices that they make in war and in peace. So there is no excuse in the American military that you were just following orders. Soldiers, sailors, airmen, and Marines are responsible as people, even in the midst of combat, for assessing whether an order is legal and moral. And if it does not meet both of those standards, they are vulnerable to prosecution under the Uniform Code of Military Justice if they carry the order out. So it's very unlikely that the American military would follow an illegal order like keeping a president who has been replaced electorally to keep him in office. The second thing is that, you know, the argument that we've removed the civilians and therefore the military could do anything is just not true. You know, the professionalization of the American military is what keeps them from being politically active. All the way up and down the line, from the most junior lance corporal to the most senior admiral, they have drilled into them the understanding that the American military has no role in American domestic politics unless they are called to service, guardsmen called to service by governors or mayors in the National Command Authority. So it's not the removal of the Secretary of Defense that ensures that the American military doesn't act unconstitutionally or illegally. It's mostly the military ethos and its own chain of command and the active sense of ownership by veterans of the military that keeps them in line. So just to take the example of the Lafayette Square incident last summer, you know, all of the living chairmen of the Joint Chiefs of Staff publicly spoke out against what General Milley did. A whole host of veterans groups objected to what he did. And the reason is that the American military knows deep in its bones that its greatest advantage is the affectionate admiration the American public has for them. After the rebuilding of the American military, when it became an all-volunteer force in 1973 and became much more professional. Remember, during the Vietnam War, we had race riots on aircraft carriers. And so rebuilding the American military to be a crisp, disciplined, professional force is the thing the American military is proudest of about itself, and it understands that that's the reason it's the most respected institution in American public life. And they don't mess around with that responsibility because they have to recruit American kids into service. So my guess is you would have to fire about the top 1,000 military officers before you could get to one who would agree to do something unconstitutional.
And so what step that the president could take in this regard at DOD would alarm you over the next 70 days? Well, you know, if the president removed so-and-so and did such-and-such, would you say, okay, I am inclined to see this in the worst possible terms as evidence that he is at least making it an effort to, however ham-handed, however ineffective it might prove to be, to not give up power?
If the president were to fire General Milley, who is halfway through a 4-year term of service as chairman, and recall to active duty Michael Flynn and make him the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff? That would genuinely alarm me. But in order to be a leader, you have to have followers. And I cannot imagine a Michael Flynn recalled to active duty would be able to command the loyalty of American troops. You'd have the service chiefs resigning. You'd have combatant commanders resign. Like, the American military takes professionalism seriously. And in a counterintuitive sense, I think the Lafayette Square incident last summer, where General Milley in combat fatigues was posing for photos in Lafayette Square, which had recently been cleared of protesters, I think that in a counterintuitive way actually has been very beneficial in this difficult moment, because you would think General Milley was politically experienced enough 3 years into a Trump administration to understand that the president was going to try and get him to put his foot in a wolf trap and behave in a way that seemed to endorse the president's actions during the protests. General Milley claims he was surprised and hadn't anticipated that, which A, he ought to have, and B, I don't think any commander in combat would accept as an excuse from a subordinate that they just didn't anticipate it and made bad choices. Be that as it may, because he made bad choices, General Milley responded in the most admirable way possible, which was a videotaped explanation and abject apology for having behaved in a manner that seemed to provide political support in a domestic dispute. And it reinforced the big, broad line of norm in civil military relations that the military shouldn't be involved in those kinds of things. I actually think it's been hugely helpful in the run-up to the election, because all the senior leadership in the Pentagon was reviewing the Constitution and the statute and did not want to get stuck in the position that General Milley allowed himself to be stuck in last summer.
All right. So scenario number two, possible motive number two, some kind of preparation for a major military action. You cite in the Atlantic article Iran as a possible target, some kind of preemptive strike on Iran. Short of that, you can imagine some spree of targeted killings of terrorist figures. The president really enjoyed the Baghdadi strike, as well as he really enjoyed the Soleimani strike. You could imagine some excited spree of stuff that the removees were not enthusiastic about, but that the president is. How do you evaluate this possibility? You call it the most alarming one.
I do think it's the most alarming one, but I also don't think it's very likely. So if we had major terrorist targets in our crosshairs, we would already be killing them. We wouldn't be waiting for a politically valuable moment to do it. I remember when I was on the NSC during the Bush administration, I remember in 2004, a wild rumor that the United States had already caught Osama bin Laden and we were keeping it secret to spring on the American people right before the election, which is such a risible notion that the American government's capable of keeping that kind of secret. And I feel the same way. If we had major terrorist targets in our crosshairs, we would be killing them anyway. We wouldn't be waiting for an electoral purpose. On Iran, it is the major action, I think, likeliest of any the president might take, for a couple of reasons. First, it was just announced that Iran has increased by a factor of 12 the uranium it had enriched since the United States withdrew from the Joint Comprehensive Plan you know, the JCPOA limiting Iranian nuclear weapons programs. So you have a precipitating announcement. Second, Secretary Pompeo is going to the Middle East and Europe next week, and some people are reading that as the possibility of prior consultation. Again, it's sweet people think that the Trump administration would consult American allies. I find that kind of unlikely because the first thing those allies will do is go immediately to the press and explain why it's a bad idea. Even the countries of the Gulf objected to the United States retaliating against Iran for its attack on Saudi Arabia September a year ago. So I don't think there would be any support. And remember, in order to attack Iran, the United States needs overflight rights from surrounding countries. It needs the support of countries in which we have American military forces based. You know, we play team sports even when we undertake unilateral military operations, and I don't think allies would give us the support for that. I also honestly don't think a president who has argued so consistently and so strenuously for getting the United States out of the Middle East would want to start a war at the end of his term. And the last thing I would say is, I think the clock is ticking, and the retaliation by Iran for the assassination of Soleimani, the attacks on American forces in Iraq, for example, Iran has the ability to do a lot of those kinds of things where around the Middle East, and the American military would want to prepare by protecting itself, removing forces from extremely exposed sites. All of those things would be visible.
All right. This brings us to possibility number three, which was the subject of a reported David Ignatius column the other day in the Washington Post. Ignatius writes that the real explanation here is that Trump desperately wants to declassify large amounts of material related to the Russia or the original Russia investigation, specifically material that he believes would show that Putin actually did not want him to win. And he's firing everybody who isn't excited about, you know, destroying U.S. sources and methods intelligence by releasing this material. The piece seemed typically David Ignatius well-sourced in the intelligence community. It actually seemed somewhat persuasive to me. You seem skeptical of it. Why?
I'm skeptical because the three most important people in the equation, as reported by David Ignatius, are Attorney General Barr, the CIA director, and the NSA director. All three of them oppose it, and all three of them still have their jobs. So, like, I can see DNI Ratcliffe wanting to do this, and I can see them massaging raw intelligence to redact anything that might be that might implicate the president with the Russians, but release anything that appears to exculpate him. But my understanding is that the reason the CIA and NSA directors oppose it is because the sources and methods by which the information was attained would tell America's adversaries very important things about what we know and how we know it, and that Attorney General Barr sided with them and that people are talking about it in the media suggests to me that it's a campaign to prevent it from occurring, not that it is occurring.
If Gina Haspel and Chris Wray and Bill Barr and Paul Nakasone started dropping over the next few days, would you reevaluate that? In other words, is this a hypothesis that's dead in your mind, or is it one that the verdict is yet out on, but you're not you're not going to believe until you see certain things start happening.
I do think the verdict is still out on it. You know, the DOD firings aren't particularly relevant to this theory. So, you know, the DOD Undersecretary for Intelligence is marginal to this. So is the Secretary of Defense. So is the Undersecretary for Policy. Yes, if I saw the CIA director and General Nakasone and the FBI director get fired, that would very strongly suggest to me that this is at least one of the reasons that this is happening, and a very disturbing one for our country's security.
It would still, though, seem to me to be an overdetermined variable, because the president hates Chris Wray for a lot of reasons, including that he won't, you know, lock up his predecessor and he won't open an investigation of Hunter Biden. And so if the president suddenly fired Chris Wray, you'd have no idea which are the reasons for it among the many conspiracy theories he has. All right. So all of this brings us to your last explanation, which is the one you embrace, which is that the simplest Occam's razor way to understand this is that this is nothing more than spite and anger and kind of the Article 2 Appointments Clause version of rage tweeting. Is that your view just because of process of elimination, or because it has significant explanatory power on its own terms?
Oh, that's a great challenge, Ben. I do think it has some explanatory power. The president's been denigrating Secretary Esper for 4 months and openly talking about firing him before this. He very much wanted Anthony Tata to be able to be making policy. Oh, one person we left out of the equation is as an advisor to the new secretary, retired Army Colonel Douglas McGregor, who's a Fox commentator of the most reprehensible type. And so, again, if these guys are playing four-dimensional chess, why make these moves with 70 days remaining when you can't really shape policy very effectively, and where you're putting in place people that the Congress hasn't consented? Sounds to me like the president's trying to pad the resumes of his favorite, most unctuous supporters. And it seems to me entirely possible. I can see a conversation where the national security advisor says, the Secretary of Defense is once again stalling on the timeline for removing troops from Afghanistan. And the president says, why don't we fire him? And while we're at it, why don't we fire these other guys and put in the folks we like at the Pentagon? That sounds like the most plausible theory to me.
All right. So let's accept your theory, which is the most reassuring of the four, since the others are all in one way or another horrifying. And then let's ask, should we be reassured by it? So, on the one hand, it suggests that we shouldn't be too worried about a sudden war with Iran or a massive declassification of sources and methods intelligence or a coup. All of that is reassuring. On the other hand, you do have the problem that the single most powerful organization in the world is now being run by Donald Trump's sycophants and people who are quite apart from that, in some of their cases quite bigoted, and in some of their cases, in all of their cases, but sort of manifestly underqualified for the roles that we're playing, albeit only for 2 months. How concerned should we be about that? Like, is the Pentagon well positioned to handle exactly the wrong kind of civilian leadership, albeit for a relatively brief period of time?
It's pretty well positioned to handle it, because you have the continuity, not just of the American military, but also of the career civil servants who are the vast majority of staff in the Office of the Secretary of Defense, and who are dedicated patriots and serious-minded people. So they are in a strong, stable position. I don't think we should be particularly worried about it. The other thing to remember is that appointed civilian leadership in the Pentagon has been mostly terrible the entirety of the Trump administration, because so much of the Republican bench in national security were opponents of the president's election, right? That all the people who signed the two Never Trump letters or who declined. Jim Mattis, when he was defense secretary, his defense to concerns about weakening civilian control of the military in the department, Jim Mattis's response was, I can't get talented people to agree to join. So I have to rely on the military staffs.
That's interesting. So when you put it all together, how concerned should we be about this? I mean, one way to read what you're saying is, hey, chill out, everybody. It's just spite and vengeance, and it's a short period of time, and there's not that much they can do because there's a large civilian cadre of professionals, and there's a uniform military with its own ethos. And so, you know, kind of let them have their fun for you know, their vengeance and spiteful fun for 2 months, and then responsible people can come in and not that much will have changed. I can hear the Bill Crystals of the world saying that sounds a little too sanguine for me.
So there is only one Bill Crystal in this world, but he has said exactly what you just predicted.
I didn't even need to know that to know that it would be true.
I admire and like Bill Crystal so much, and I deeply respect his judgment on this. You know, he could be right, but I myself am only a 2 on a scale of 10 concerned about this, because I think there's so much resilience and strength in the system. I haven't yet talked to Bill to know which of the potential scenarios he's most concerned about. I'd be surprised if he were concerned about the military allowing itself to keep the president in office. My guess is that Bill would likely be most concerned about the use of the American military in an attack on Iran or any of the other use of military force scenarios.
So you say you were at a 2 out of 10 on the alarm scale. That's pretty low, and that actually makes me feel better. What are you on the lookout for that would raise your alarm higher, short of the replacement of the Joint Chiefs with Michael Flynn?
So perhaps the thing I love best about the American government is how incredibly porous it is for information to come out and for ideas to go in. And if there were beginning to be plans for a military strike, every defense reporter in the country would be watching whether weapons are being loaded onto airplanes, whether troops are being moved, right? All of the, we have such great defense journalists and civil society groups who pay careful attention to these things. So it'd be very difficult to keep that a secret, especially if it was something as dangerous as either a president trying to use the military to stay in power or to, you know, walk out the door by doing something incendiary and bad for the country's security. And, you know, it's important to remember that the president's not the entirety of civilian control of the military. The executive branch isn't the entirety of control, civilian control of the military. The Congress is equally, and in many cases, even more important than the commander-in-chief and the executive branch. And one of the things the Senate Armed Services Committee makes every two-star general or admiral and above swear when they are going through their confirmation process is that if they ever believe the President of the United States is conducting a policy that they don't support, they have to swear that they will come and tell the Congress that. And I genuinely believe that there have been a number of conversations going on since the Lafayette Square incident between the Congress and the military leadership to do exactly what you just challenged me to do, Ben, which is say, what would make you worried that you're being put in a position that's bad for the country? And Congress, in a bipartisan way, I genuinely believe, you know, the Armed Services Committees came out in a bipartisan opposition to the president moving money to the border wall that had been appropriated for other purposes. And I think they would come together even more strongly on something like this.
There you have it, people. We bring you the case for alarm about all kinds of things. Here we are bringing you the case for complacency. And I happen to think it is a persuasive one. Corey Shockey, thanks so much for joining us.
It was a great pleasure, my friend.
The Lawfare Podcast is produced in cooperation with the Brookings Institution, our audio engineer. This episode is the intrepid Zachary Frank of Goat Rodeo, carefully navigating all the audio screw-ups that the Jungle Studio can throw his way. You need to do your part to promote the Lawfare Podcast, so share us on Facebook, tweet us, make TikTok videos about us if you have downloaded TikTok, which you really shouldn't do. Upvote us on Reddit. You know all the things. The Lawfare Podcast is produced and edited by Jen Patya Howell. Our music is performed by Sophia Yan. Leave us a rating and review wherever you found us. Buy our merch at thelawfarestore.com. And as always, thanks for listening.
Whether you're a morning person or a bedtime procrastinator, everyone deserves a mattress that works for their style. And you'll find the best mattress for you at Ashley. The new Tempur-Adapt collection at Ashley brings you one-of-a-kind body-conforming technology, making every sleep tailored to be your best. The collection also features cool-to-the-touch covers and motion absorption to help minimize sleep disruptions from partners, pets, or kids. Shop the all-new Tempur-Adapt collection at Ashley in-store or online at ashley.com. Ashley, for the love of home.